The first case for argument is the Chicago Truck Drivers Pension Fund v. El Paso. Mr. Christina.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Tom Christina, and I represent the El Paso defendants in this matter. The central issue in this case is whether the El Paso defendants waived their right to contest the basis on which the plaintiff fund seeks withdrawal liability from them. The purported basis for the waiver was an alleged failure to seek fund review and demand arbitration timely. The district court erred as a matter of law in granting summary judgment on that basis.
If you had asked for arbitration, would you have been able to get it?
According to the holding of the district court, no.
Why not? No, if you'd asked, you know, within the 60 days or 180 days?
If measured from...
No, my question is, if you'd asked it, if you had sought it in whatever someone thinks is a timely fashion, would the arbitrator have been able to, competent, authorized to decide the issue?
Yes. The MEPA requires that a multi-employer plan notify an employer of an assessment in accordance with sections 4201 through
40. What if you have actual knowledge?
Your Honor, we do not think that that satisfies the statutory criteria because of the language of 4202 and 4219, which require that the plan notify the employer. So the precondition for triggering the 90-day period is that the plan notifies the employer, and then once the employer receives...
What are you looking at?
we begin in 4202.
What's 4202?
It's 29 U.S.C. 1382.
Okay.
I'll use the U.S. Code sections if I can. It begins, when an employer withdraws from a multi-employer plan, the plan sponsor, meaning the Board of Trustees, in accordance with this part, shall, and then it lists three things, the second of which is notify the employer of the amount of the withdrawal liability. Then 29 U.S.C. Section 1399, specifically B1, provides, as soon as practicable, after an employer's complete or partial withdrawal, the plan sponsor shall, and then subparagraph A is, notify the employer of, among other things, the amount of the liability scheduled for payments.
We've got case law against you on this point, though, don't you?
I don't think we do, Your Honor, because at least in the Seventh Circuit, there aren't any cases which hold that without the notice being given to the putative employer or a member of its controlled group, the limitations period can start running. If I may have a moment.
Well, there's a case that says if you file a claim in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, that's good enough. This is a Chapter 7, but that's the only distinction.
Is your Honor referring to the Slotkey opinion?
Slotkey, yeah.
But on the facts of Slotkey, Mr. Slotkey himself also received a copy of the proof of claim directed to him.
But look, this is your 50% subsidiary. If it's in bankruptcy, that's something of great significance to you, that is to your client, to El Paso.
Your Honor,
don't ignore those things, surely. I mean, your client doesn't ignore that sort of stuff.
Depending on the circumstances, the bankruptcy of a 50-50 subsidiary may or may not be a matter of tremendous significance.
I don't believe that. I don't buy that.
But in any event, I think the fund...
How large was El Paso's investment?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, because...
Well, that's kind of important, isn't it? You say there are situations in which company is indifferent to the bankruptcy of its subsidiary. Well, that would depend on how much stake it had in the subsidiary.
Yes, and I think also...
But you don't seem to know.
How much...
You don't have any idea.
I do not, Your Honor. I know that it was acquired as part of the acquisition of a natural resource.
That makes... I'm curious whether they had a significant stake or whether it was just, you know, penny ante stuff, write it off, proof of claim, who cares?
I apologize that I do not know the answer to that.
Well, and with respect to that proof of claim, when it was filed, the defendants complied with the requirements of 4219B and in terms of the demand and the schedule of payments, and so there really was actual notice. And so I'm trying to struggle, too, with what's the harm, what's the... I mean, especially when you look at that Slotsky case.
As Your Honor knows, we also... disagree with the fund about those points. But the point I'm making here is it is the fact of directing the notice to a particular person that makes that notice give the person awareness that the demand is being made against it.
A proof of claim is filed in a... This is a Chapter 7?
It had been converted.
So it's filed in a liquidation bankruptcy, which means it's probably worth very little, right?
That may be true, yes.
And here there is this big pocket parent, El Paso. So wasn't it obvious to your client that this proof of claim was going to be followed up with an effort to reach the assets of the rich parent?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that was obvious. And in any event, the test under the statute is not whether a prospective defendant happens to guess correctly.
But look, the problem is that I see it is under the rule that you're advocating, a multi-employer fund would, to protect its right to get arbitration, would have to send a notice to every possible former employer, right?
Otherwise,
say, even though these people knew, you know, they were former employers, knew everything, they don't get the actual piece of paper, they can't be brought in.
No, Your Honor, that's not what we're suggesting, and for two reasons. First, it would clearly be sufficient if the piece of paper were sent to any member of the former owner's then existing control group. That's Slotsky, and we don't quarrel with that. The second reason we disagree is that if a fund instead wanted to say in the proof of claim something indicating that it was going to go after former owners, we believe that would be sufficient as well. It's the absence...
I don't understand you. That would be sufficient? Even though it wasn't sent to El Paso?
El Paso would be on notice that it is directed at them.
You. It's on notice because it's mentioned in a notice to another company? That's completely inconsistent with your argument that actual knowledge isn't enough.
Maybe I should try to explain this somewhat differently. It's not merely awareness that there is a claim for withdrawal liability. There also has to be awareness that you yourself are the potential target of that withdrawal liability. The fund is claiming that you owe it money.
This is slicing hairs. I mean, you're saying that if the proof of claim says, and by the way, you know, we're going to go after your parent, although why would you put that in a proof of claim? But even if you did, that's enough, you say. But if it's merely obvious that there's a very high likelihood that the claimant will go after the deep pocket parent, that's not enough. What's the point of that distinction?
I think, Your Honor, the reason for the distinction is that in order to go after the former parent, everyone acknowledges that the fund would have to make a finding under 1392C, the evade or avoid provision, And no one except the fund knows whether or not it does that. That's something that the fund has complete...
That's another problem. Another problem with your case is that the nature of the transaction between a parent and a... or between the... between Coastal and its... and, what, ATC that it made the deal with, that... that's something known to them better than it, more than it is to the plan. The plan isn't privy to the negotiations and motivations and so on of the transaction.
Well, it does have the statutory authority to request information that it reasonably concludes it needs to admit to decide any question under the statute. But more to the point,
what do you mean, to bring a suit against? El Paso? That's the only way I can get the...
Well, hopefully most employers would cooperate with a demand for information under the statute. But
and if they don't, you have to sue them, right?
That may be true, yes, Your Honor. But only the fund knows how it evaluates the facts, because only the fund has the power to decide whether it believes a certain transaction is an evade or avoid transaction. And so there's a fact uniquely within the knowledge of the fund. And unless someone knows that the fund has gone one way rather than another...
Knowledge. What's in your knowledge is whether the transaction is a sham.
The district court held that, actually, that evidence was irrelevant on summary judgment. We offered evidence showing...
I'm talking about evidence. I'm talking about what... the respective parties know, and the fund knows maybe what its intentions are, and you know whether it's a sham transaction or arguably sham or might get you into trouble, and then you can ask for arbitration.
I think
you could have asked for arbitration. You're not arguing that you couldn't have asked for arbitration, are you?
In the absence of a notice and demand, the statute doesn't contemplate an arbitration. And volunteering to arbitrate a question like that could have been taken as an admission by conduct.
Of what?
That we believe that there was reason to suspect that we should be returned to the control group.
Well, it's like a declaratory judgment, isn't it? You don't acknowledge anything by bringing in a declaratory judgment. All you acknowledge is, well, you're likely to be sued, so you're going to try to anticipate, right?
In a declaratory judgment, I think it's required to allege that there is an actual controversy between the parties. And what triggers the controversy is the application of the evade or avoid section, which is something over which the former employer has no control. The fund either believes that it was or believes that it wasn't. And so, it's true, as Your Honor says, we may be privy to certain facts about the transaction. It would be sort of irresponsible if we weren't. But what we don't know is the legally operative consequence, because we don't know how the fund has evaluated it. That's the purpose, in our minds, of requiring that the fund notify a prospective target. Another way to put it is, it's not merely the fact of what's in the document, it's the fact of to whom it's directed that conveys that information.
Now, you mentioned the Slotkey case, but isn't our decision in Banner your biggest hurdle?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in Banner, the notice and demand actually was sent directly to Banner Industries, the former parent. And so at a minimum, it's distinguishable on that basis. But in addition...
How do you distinguish Slotsky again?
Mr. Slotsky, the withdrawing employer in that case was Stevens Bedding Company, I believe. It was undisputed that Mr. Slotsky was the 100% shareholder of that company at all relevant times. The notice and demand was sent to Mr. Slotsky himself, and he was not trying to argue oh, no, I'm not in that controlled group. He tried to argue, I'm not a trader of business, and that proved to be wrong. In fact, it may be helpful if I can find the page site. I see my time, except for the rebuttal time, has expired. And I would like to reserve that rebuttal time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Christina. Mr. O'Donnell?
May it please the Court. My name is Jim O'Connell, and I represent the Plaintiff Pension Fund and its trustee in the argument this morning. Your Honors, let me first address one of the questions that was raised by the panel. I think, Judge Posner, you asked the question in terms of the interest of the parent with respect to the bankruptcy of the company that it was formerly in a controlled group with. And I would refer to, Your Honor, to Fund Appendix, page 91, where the trustee in bankruptcy has his addendum on the first page of the lawsuit that he filed against the former parent in the amount of $97 million. So it's, we're not talking about...
Where is this?
At Fund Appendix, page 91. It's the first page of the complaint that was filed by the trustee in the A&R bankruptcy against the former parent, current creditor, to the tune of $97 million. It was a combination of equitable subordination, of loans. The company had made millions and millions of loans to A&R after the divestiture.
This is a suit against El Paso, or a claim against El Paso, or what?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a claim against, technically, Coastal was the name of the company at the time, but yes, it's the same company as El Paso today. They just changed their name. So I submit that yes, indeed, the interest of the parent was significant, and there's certainly reason to believe that they're going to get the notice of this proof of claim. It's a matter of common sense. Secondly, indeed, as the court pointed out, perhaps the biggest hurdle for the defendants is the Banner case. It was Banner in which this court first enunciated the distinction between a company that at one time was an employer in the control group with the company that later withdrew and a company that was never in the control group with the company that withdrew. If the company was once in the control group, Banner makes it clear that company will be liable for the later withdrawal unless it complies with the arbitration requirements of the statute.
How far would you extend that? What if it was 100 years ago, you know, that it employed members of this union, and then it's sold and, you know, it's forgotten about it and so on?
My answer to, well, I'm... 1980 was when MEFA was passed, so certainly that would be the farthest we can go. I think the answer legally...
What did you say about 1980?
Is when MEPA, the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendment...
Right. This law may be in effect 100 years from now.
Oh, yes. Well taken. Yes, Your Honor. What I think legally the answer is that it's an issue of ultimately how far the arbitration requirements of the statute are applied. That is a question committed to the discretion of the district court. In each case, essentially what will occur is that in a scenario like that, the employer will come in and say, hey, I don't deserve to be denied my day in court. And they will explain why they think they should be excused from the arbitration requirements of the statute. If they make a compelling case like the one Your Honor just said, district court may exercise its discretion to waive or excuse them from the arbitration requirements, in which case they can be heard. But that's not this case, Your Honor.
That sounds a little fuzzy. Are you talking about equitable tolling or some other doctrine of deserved excuse or something, or what?
Your Honor, I think they're both... I think it's the name for it is discretion, in the sense that
Wait, name for discretion? No, you can't have a doctrine called discretion. It has no structure.
It's in... The arbitration requirement of MEPA has been construed as an administrative exhaustion requirement as opposed to a jurisdictional bar. An administrative exhaustion requirement is something under the case law generally that's committed to the discretion of the district court as to whether or not to waive it in a particular case. In one branch of cases, this court has established equitable tolling as a reason why the district court might let the employer off the hook and give them a second bite at the apple. But that doctrine has been clearly enunciated to require the employer to take quick action as soon as it gets notice of the assessment and raise the defense that they want to preserve. And this court has pointed out in Banner, has pointed out in Slotkey, and on numerous other occasions that they're not going to reward parties who get actual notice of an assessment and then sit back and wait to be sued. That's precisely what happened in this case. These people had actual notice of the proof of claim. Indeed, the context shows that it was after they had been sued for $97 million by the trustee in the bankruptcy, and among the allegations in that complaint were the assertion by the trustee that the reason why this company divested 50% of its interest in ANR prior to the bankruptcy was in order to evade withdrawal liability. That was made in December of 2000. In 2001, an agent of one of the corporate affiliates goes to look at the proofs of claim in the ANR bankruptcy. Why? For the purpose of doing due diligence in connection with the settlement of the trustee's allegations. In the course of reviewing claims for the due diligence, they've admitted that he reviewed our fund's proof of claim, along with some other funds' proofs of claim, presumably. Thus, it wasn't a situation, indeed, it's hard to think of a situation where there's more precise focus given to the fact that there's a case coming against you and that you need to take action. Indeed, depending on how far into the facts you want to drill, we've got handwritten notes and a motion to supplement that we asked the district court to consider by a man who appears to be Mr. McKeamy, who reviewed the proof of claim. And the notes say, within 90 days of notice, must initiate dispute resolution process. I mean, not only did they have actual knowledge of the assessment, they had actual knowledge of the law and actual knowledge that they had 90 days to act. This is not a case where these people should be let off the hook and excused from the requirements of the statute to arbitrate promptly.
Well, I said if they volunteered for arbitration, that would be an admission. Is that what's your response to that?
My response to that is I believe that was answered in the Barker case initially, where the same argument was made to the Third Circuit, and they said file a declaratory judgment, as Judge Posner recommended. Secondly, I submit that under the court's Banner decision, which says once you're a one-time employer, it's your job to raise the defense in a timely fashion, they could simply cite that and say, that's why we're doing this, Your Honor. We're a one-time employer, but we've got our argument that we exited the control group in time before the withdrawal. So I submit there's no admission in taking action. They should have taken action. I'm just going to sum up my argument on liability and then move on to damages, if I may, just by saying that the district court here had a more than sufficient basis for declining to exercise its discretion to excuse these defendants from the arbitration requirements of the statute as enunciated in Banner by this circuit. They had actual notice of the proof of claim by January 1st of 2002. They waited until they were sued, and then in 2005 they filed a demand for arbitration. 3 years later is too late. It's hard to think of a better case for a waiver of defenses than this one. The defendants gambled. The defendants lost. It's a self-inflicted wound. Turning, if I may, to our cross-appeal, unless there are further questions on liability from the court. I submit with respect to damages, there are two independent reasons why the damages judgment of the district court needs to be remanded and reversed. The first is court's failure to follow basic American on when withdrawal liability is due in a case like this. And secondly, the court's failure to advise the fund that it intended to consider summary judgment on damages on the defendant's theories without giving the fund notice of its intention to consider those issues and a chance to respond. I'd like to address the basic American legal point first because the case is simpler, frankly, under that way of looking at it. And indeed, in the course of procedure of this case, that was the only damages argument we presented to the district court in our motion for summary judgment. Most of that motion was with respect to liability. We raised one argument with respect to damages and submitted the facts were uncontested with respect to what we call the basic American theory of damages. The facts, as it relates to this theory, are fairly simple. 1998, there's a withdrawal. 1999, there's a Chapter 7 proceeding and a proof of claim filed by the fund. Rules of precedent based on basic American and sound policy require that we recognize that the debt was accelerated on the date of the filing of the proof of claim. The defendants, of course, have argued that basic American is distinguishable because in that case it was a statute of limitations argument. But I submit that the question of when the debt is due cannot differ depending on
whether
the question.
Isn't there a notice problem, though, with your argument here? You didn't give any notice, which the statute requires, of your intent to claim a default.
Well, the way I think of that, is, Your Honor, is in two steps. First is there is the potential for constructive notice in the proof of claim itself. Now, in this case, the court did not reach that issue. The court decided that the waiver of all the arguments by the defendants occurred in 2002 when they had actual notice of the proof of claim. So he didn't reach the constructive notice issue. But now my submission to this court is that having waived all questions as to liability, and frankly the statute says as to questions of schedule of payments, now we come to the question of what's the dollar amount of the judgment the pension fund gets as a matter of law that's due and owing. And I submit on that issue, we're really just focusing here on the question of when does interest commence to run. And in that sense, I submit that there's nothing unfair or improper with giving a defendant a chance to argue about interest in 2002, and then if they elect not to raise any arguments about liability or damages, then the interest runs, as indicated in our proof of claim, accelerated in the full amount on the date of the filing of the proof of claim. Interest starts to accrue from then.
How much is involved in your cross appeal?
In the cross appeal, my rough number is $500,000. I'm roughing out the amount of interest due between June 3rd of 1999 and the time.
Another $500,000. How much did you get? Have you got? Or was awarded?
The court essentially awarded a few thousand dollars worth of interest.
No, but how large is this issue in relation to the whole case? That's my question.
I'd say it's about one-third of the case, just roughing it out. It's $1.7 million withdrawal liability principal, and it's about $500,000 and change in interest.
The statute's got rather elaborate provisions about notice of default, does it not?
Well, yes, Your Honor, very good point, and actually, it's a nice segue into my last argument. What I would say first about basic American is that, while Your Honor is right, and the statute has two very specific default acceleration provisions, I think this court was clear in basic American is saying, well, nothing in that prevents us, the court, from using common sense and importing some concepts from common law. And in a situation where you've got a proof of claim filed in a bankruptcy and you know that company is never going to pay on a schedule, who are we kidding? The debt is accelerated on the date the proof of claim is filed if that's the last of the relevant events that must occur in terms of withdrawal, notice and demand, and the bankruptcy itself.
But see, I have the same problem. I mean, this is very specific in the statute, and I think this is a little different from the other notice issue we were discussing. And given that it's this accelerated schedule, don't you think that this was crafted to give further protection?
Well, all I can say is the statute obviously had specific designs in terms of those two acceleration provisions. I'm not sure I can see anything in the statute that says there's no other way that acceleration can occur. Clearly, it can occur in those two ways, but federal common law has been used repeatedly by the courts to fill perceived gaps in the statute. And I think what this court was saying in Basic American is that there's a gap in the statute with respect to acceleration in this kind of peculiar situation where there's a bankruptcy filed and there's no way they can pay on a schedule. If that's the case, there can't be a proof of claim for payment on a schedule. The fund can't sue for payment on a schedule. It's all accelerated in a lump sum. Fund has to sue within 6 years of that date. And I submit the flip side for the benefit of the pension fund is that conversely, then, that's when interest should start to accrue.
You're making the filing in bankruptcy serve a number of functions here, right? I mean,
I guess we're doing our best
all these specific statutory requirements.
Well, if Your Honor's concern, again, is notice, I submit that if the El Paso defendants had an issue about the amount, they should have raised that in 2002 because the statute is very specific saying request review employer if you have an issue about the amount that's been demanded by the fund. I think the proof of claim was clear on its face. It's asking for $1.7 million. I submit that the other thing that's important about this and the question of how the statute should be applied is the purpose of the statute. As Your Honor knows, in terms of construing provisions of the statute and whether or not there's a gap in the statute, we look to what the statute is about. I submit there are two important policies that support the argument that we're making here in terms of supporting the basic Americanist precedent. One, as Your Honor's known, as the Schlitz case in the Supreme Court and this court has pointed out, statute is all about preventing the dumping of liabilities from one employer onto the remaining employers in the fund, or ultimately the PBGC. Look at this case. If the district court's decision is upheld with respect to damages, these defendants have a 5-year pass with respect to interest between the day of the proof of claim and all the period when they were gambling that maybe they wouldn't get tagged. I submit that 5 years lost time value of money should not be shifted to the remaining defendants, employers in the fund. Secondly, the other point I would make, Your Honor, looking again at the specific terms of the statute with respect to acceleration and interest, is that wherever you look in the statute, it says interest starts to accrue when the debt is due. If you look at this case, I don't see much of an argument that the debt was due on any date other than the date the proof of claim was filed. That's a notice and demand. It's been acknowledged as such. It's in the full amount of the liability.
Just to clarify your original argument, so your argument is the proof of claim was notification to a member of the control group? Is that the argument?
Notification to all members of the control group. Notice to one is notice to all, as this court has said on repeated occasions.
So, but you're treating the proof of claim as the notification?
We're treating, yes, the proof of claim as the notice and demand, if you will. And I submit that complies with the notice provision of the statute. Then the only issue is, constitutionally, did they have sufficient notice under the statute as it's written? I submit no question in this case they certainly did, albeit 2 years later, as the district court found, when they actually reviewed the proof of claim, read it, knew exactly what they had to do in order to protect their rights under the statute and under Banner and the court's precedent. Let me spend a moment, if I may, on the other issue with respect to damages that we would ask the court.
The curiosity of that is that their argument is that the subsidiary is not a member of control group.
Well, that's correct, and I submit there is a tension between a parent that claims that while it was once in a controlled group of the subsidiary, it's no longer in the controlled group, and the issue of liability, which tends to be viewed on the date of withdrawal, and you look to the control group on the date of withdrawal. But I think the Banner case addressed that issue squarely by essentially saying you resolve the tension by saying you're going to interpret this treatment of everyone in the control group as a single employer as in connection with the arbitration requirements of the statute and say the only way this is going to work is to have effectively an obligation on the employer once it becomes a member of the controlled group to properly exit the control group via the arbitration requirements of the statute. If it fails to do that, as in Banner's language, it will be liable.
Group anyway?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What's the definition of a control group?
Control group, essentially, it's the language is to the effect that all trades or businesses under common control shall be treated as single.
El Paso had 51% of, what is it, ANC, ATC, or ARN, whatever it is. Would that be control?
Oh, it's 80%, Your Honor, typically.
80%.
Yes.
It had 80% to have control, but divested itself of 30%. Yeah.
Okay. Exactly right. So at the time, in 1995, where this story starts, they were 100% owner of A&R Freight, then they decided, as I think the record suggests, that they had better divest themselves of 50% of their interest, because you can kind of see where this is heading. And they do that. The company tanked a few years later after they prop it up with these loans. You know, they get sued. There's withdrawal liability claims filed. They have lawyers writing memos. Indeed, starting before we even filed the proof of claim, they knew the withdrawal liability evade and avoid argument was coming. And they elected, obviously, to gamble and see if they could fly under the radar. When it turned out that was not possible, then they waived, essentially, their defenses. But they knew that's what they were doing, I submit. And it's appropriate, certainly constitutionally, within obviously appropriate bounds to bind them with that determination, as the statute does. The last point I will... let me just say in conclusion that the policies of the statute in terms of avoiding dumping of liabilities on others, encouraging the prompt resolution in a non-judicial way of these disputes, merits the affirmance of the liability judgment and reversal of the judgment with respect to interest. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank you, Judge.
O'Connell, I'm sorry. Mr. Christina, how much time does he have? 5 minutes?
I believe I have 5 minutes, Your Honor. Thank you. The fund has made several arguments that I can't agree with, but in the time remaining to me, I'll try to address what I regard as the more important of them. The first is that the fund now claims that it was the filing of the proof of claim in the bankruptcy court that functioned as the notice and demand in this case. If that is true, then by the time the record reflects my clients became aware of it, their time to request, to demand fund review and then demand arbitration had already run. So I think what they have to be arguing is something different from what the issues were in the district court. And I think Mr. O'Connell told you what that argument is, which is that Mr. O'Connell proposes that Banner be applied now on a case-by-case basis in the district courts, where there will be a hearing on whether the court should exercise its discretion. And whether you call that discretion or whether you call it equitable tolling, I believe that's ruled out in Slotkey, as I believe the possibility of bringing a declaratory.
You've lost me. So if the proof of claim was the notification, then you had, 180 days to ask for arbitration?
I believe it is 90 days to request fund review, which is a prerequisite to demanding arbitration. It's a two-stage.
And then?
And then 120 days from the earlier of when the request for review, when the review is issued, or the last day on which it could have been issued if it's not issued.
So now what's your complaint? I don't understand. So you had that time after the proof of claim?
No one has argued that we were aware of the proof of claim the day it was filed.
Well, you became aware sometime afterward.
But I believe what the plaintiffs are now arguing is that because the statutory act of notice, they claim, was the filing of the proof of claim, it would logically follow that that's the point at which these deadlines would start to run.
What difference does it make? Did you ever ask for arbitration?
Yes. When we got an actual notice and demand, mail...
Well, how is that? I don't understand. Now you've lost me. So one possibility is the filing of the proof of claim, because it's noticed to the member of the former control group or something. That's one possibility. That's when this complicated statute of limitations starts to run. Another is what? When the proof of claim was forwarded to you? To your client?
When a proof of, it was actually a notice and demand letter to which the proof of claim was attached, was sent to us, yes.
And I don't understand. Didn't your subsidiary forward the proof of claim to you? Client?
I don't believe that's in the record, but even assuming that that's what happened, as I said earlier, the fact that it was not directed to us...
Forget that. That's a separate issue. forget directed to you. When did your client, or what does the record show about when your client learned that a proof of claim had been filed against its subsidiary?
Between September 2001 and January 1st, 2002.
When was the proof of claim filed?
June.
The proof of claim was filed June 3rd, 1999.
Are you saying it took years before you learned that your subsidiary was being sued for all this?
The proof of claim wasn't a suit against the subsidiary.
Well, whatever it is. Okay, proof of claim
yes.
Submitted June 3rd, 1999. And when did El Paso learn about it?
The record shows that they became aware of it between September 1st, 2000 and January 1st, 2002.
Well, that's a good reason for treating the proof of claim as the notification.
The proof of claim doesn't indicate that it's a claim against us. It would have been in the fund's... If the fund thought that we were liable for this, the fund could have given itself a right to interim
what
payments immediately.
What about all this other evidence that Mr. O'Connell mentioned?
Yes, that was the next point.
That your company's fears that they were going to be...
Yes, I want... My time has expired. May I answer? Mr. O'Connell alluded, among other things, to the McCamey notes. Those were not before the district court on summary judgment, and I believe that this court has held in United States versus Rohde Corporation that's not properly before this court in reviewing the summary
Where
judgment.
Where were they? I don't understand. Are they in the record or not in the record?
They were in the record because they were filed with a motion to supplement the record, which the district court denied as moot.
And what are we talking about? I didn't hear your answer.
These are the what Mr. O'Connell referred to as the notes from Mr. McCamey in his argument.
These are the memoranda between the lawyers?
The memoranda is another item that he referred to, and also those also were not part of the summary judgment record.
Okay, do you have anything further you need to say?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.